there's moonbeams in your elbows, and there's rivers in your hair. And I wanna see you forever, babe, forever. Don't take me back in time now, but there's nothing for me there. Welcome to On the Wink Podcast, fueled by Purina Pro Plan. One of the charms of National Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic, where I am recording this particular episode, is the convergence of leaders in conservation from all over the country, from all sorts of different organizations. They gather together with our organization. We consider them our very best friends. And they've joined us in Kansas City this weekend. And I've grabbed three of those folks, three of our friends, to have a conversation, a little bit of crystal balling and a little bit of Aldo Leopold talk. And I'm honored to be joined by Ed Arnett, the CEO of the Wildlife Society, Patrick Berry, the CEO of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, and Ted Cook, the executive director of North American Grouse Partnership. I was reading this. Okay, I got two CEOs and one executive director. What's the distinction between the two? Is there any semantics. Distinction? No?
Semantics.
I don't know.
Yeah. They mean the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. So we will have them each introduce themselves in a minute. As I mentioned, Purina Pro Plan is the presenting sponsor of On the Wing Podcast. They're a national sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's Wildlife Habitat Mission. And that means my pups, Esky, Gitchy, and Winter, all eat Purina Pro Plan, not just because Purina supports the Wildlife Habitat Mission of our organization, but because Purina has the team of the world's best scientists and nutritionists behind their dog food. It's a double whammy. They support conservation, and they create the fuel that your bird dog needs to go find feathers all season long. Learn more at ProPlanSport.com. Purina Pro Plan, nutrition that performs. And only fitting that we start with dogs. And I'm told, I know each of you guys a little bit. I know you the least, Ed, right? Because we just met today. I know each of you a little bit, and I'm told you're all bird dog guys. And they're, you know, the photos on the phones are coming out. So we'll start.
I don't even have my kids' photo on my screen lock. It's the dogs.
So we'll start with Patrick, who whipped out the photos first. So I want to hear the round robin of bird dogs, and then we'll talk about your career path. So we'll start with your bird dogs, Patrick. What breed? How many have you always had the same one?
I have generally always had the same breed. I'm a dyed-in-the-wool English Springer Spaniel enthusiast, and I think for those that know me, it just fits my personality.
Describe that for us.
Okay, I didn't say that it matched my personality. My dogs are generally a hell of a lot smarter, and they are actually calmer than I am. No, the remarkable thing about Springers, field-bred Springers, in my opinion, is, and this is true of mine, is they've got a pretty finely tuned off switch, right? One of my buddies who was a retired Marine once said, Springers are like Marines. They can stand still and salute or blow the place up. And that seemed pretty accurate because they're more like goldfish around the house where they just kind of generally hang out. But they're pretty high-powered dogs. I have four, and I have a fifth one on the way. I have three Springers, and I train them all for field trials and for hunting as well. And I think that training for one helps with the other and vice versa. Mm. But I have three Springers, and we have a Cocker that is more my wife's dog, but little Marty will get he'll get trained up too. And then at the end of next week, I'm going to go pick up another dog as well. And but you know, to the
and what will the new dog be?
Springer.
So it'd be four Springers and a Cocker.
I'm the Springer guy. My wife's the Cocker person in the family, right? This will be her second. But no, what I do like about Springers is I am a pretty intense guy, as you all probably know, and pretty high energy. And you know, when you're hunting behind a flushing dog, especially if you've got one that's got a lot of pace, like a field bred Springer will, you're always in perpetual motion hunting with the dog. You're a team at all times. You're never not hunting with the dog. And that just suits me pretty darn well. Mm. And, you know, I love their affection and their biddability. And, Chuck Fergus, the guy who wrote the book Hunter's Book of Days, who was a Springer guy, he's a friend. And he said to me one time, you have to really be attached to the aesthetics of your breed of choice, right? Mm-hmm. You gotta like the way they look.
You're right on.
And Springers just kind of suit me as well in a lot of ways too. So I could talk for the entire podcast about my dogs, but I need to share the floor. I know that.
Your favorite name of a dog you've ever had?
Boy, that's a good one.
As an example, not to cut you off, I just did the Bird Dog Parade, which we had 108 different breeds. And one of the dog's names, swear to God, was Oreo Speedwagon. And they called Oreo. That was a funny name.
Yeah. But you get to call him whatever you want.
Yeah, yeah.
We rotate names around the family, right? Okay. So everybody gets to choose. I generally get left out of that since I train the dogs. But I have to say, my wife's dog, the Cocker, is named Marty. And that dog is such a Marty. I don't even know.
Which Marty? McFly?
McFly's the one that I was thinking too.
Maybe more of a Martin Short, right? Okay. So, small, incredible, smart ass, pretty sharp. But out of the Springers, the one I'm picking up next week, I'm attached to the name because I named it after, I shouldn't say this, but my favorite uncle. So his name it will be Huey when he gets home. My middle name too. So there you go.
Yeah. All right. So we go to Springers, backcountry hunters and anglers, Patrick. One more question about dog. Do you have any idea what the most popular breed of dog is in the BHA community?
I do not, but I'm going to guess that there are probably more lab enthusiasts because of the versatility for, all kinds of different, waterfowl, upland, et cetera. And I do really – I train my dogs for waterfowl hunting, but there's just a reality that they don't have the underfur of labs, and even though they've got their 5-mil vests, when it gets cold, I have one of my dogs can handle the cold, and actually there's a video posted on the BHA social media channel in middle of December in ice and snow, crashing through the ice on a blind retrieve. Huh. I took these local college kids out hunting in one of my favorite spots, and so he can handle it, but it's not recommended when it gets that cold for Springers. And I think labs are, because of the versatility and household dog pet kind of thing, or probably I'm going to guess. That's a guess.
It's America's dog. It's the most popular breed, and it's the most popular breed in the Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever.
Is it really?
There you go. Labs by quite a ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
Short hairs would be number two, but labs are by far the most popular breed, even in the uplands.
Yeah, I gotta just say one thing. Go back 20 years, and I always used to try to convince everybody that Springers were the greatest dog for this, that, and the other. And in the end, no one really cares. Everybody has their breed of choice that they love for whatever reason. And trying to convince them otherwise is like trying to change somebody's mind on social media on religion or politics. I mean, you already know what you think, right? And I anybody that is kind to their dog and the dog is happy, man, you're okay in my book.
And we will go to the North American Grouse Partnership Executive Director, Ted Cook. What kind of breed do you have?
First, I think I need to aspire to become a CEO.
Yeah.
Even though I don't know the difference.
For the record, my position used to be called executive director, just so you know.
Then you got
why'd they change it?
Yeah.
Do you know the catalyst? No?
No.
Look at this guy. Does he look like an executive director? I mean, that's a CEO right there.
When the position was flown, that's what they flew it at.
I feel like it's kind of like, you know, 40 years ago there were a bunch of colleges. Now everything's a university. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the difference? No, yeah, I'm sure there, anyway. So, noting the fact that I was a BHA North American board member until the end of 2024, and to your point and your question to Patrick, my dog's a lab for all the reasons Patrick said. So I don't know. And that you said about, you know, members of
Pheasants Forever
is really, that's me.
Matches you.
Yeah.
What about North American Grouse Partnership broadly? Do you have any sense of what the most common breed is amongst your members in your community?
Well, pointers, I think almost for sure. You know, notably, the North American Grouse Partnership was founded by falconers. Mm-hmm. And it actually is very interesting. We had our 25th anniversary year last year. The morning after peregrine falcons were delisted from the Endangered Species Act in Boise, Idaho, Tom Cade, founder of the Peregrine Fund from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and a major falconer, had a meeting in his basement the next morning and formed the North American Grouse Partnership.
Wow.
And falconers are all upland bird dog mm-hmm. lovers. And so, and we still have a heavy falconry influence in our organization today. And falconers are very proud of their legacy with our organization and frankly are looking to step back up and, you know, to try to save grasslands. And
have you ever watched a falconer hunt?
Yes. In fact,
it's like, it's magic.
Yeah. You know, it's Aldo Leopold said, the most noble hobby a man can have.
Really?
He called falconry. And yes, and so I actually was a falconer myself.
Really?
But I mainly became a falconer because a man by the name of Morley Nelson lived just up the street from me. He was a legend in the falconry community. In fact, he was a mentor of Dr. Cade's back in the early days. And he taught me how to fly a golden eagle named Slim.
Hmm.
And so I used to fly this golden eagle, and we made movies for PBS and stuff, and it was really amazing.
You
stuff.
Made movies for PBS?
Well, I flew the eagle.
Okay.
I was not in it. I was the eagle trainer.
When I say magic, I'm baffled by how much work it takes to train, you know, and with falconers. I think it's universally pointing breeds, right?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you spend so much time training a pointer to lock down a bird or a covey of birds, sharptails. Let's say sharptails in Montana, right?
Yeah.
Lock down a point, and then you got this falcon on your arm,
yeah.
Right? Dog's on point, and you release it,
yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
The falcon goes up until they get to a apex, right? And then they stoop. Is that
yes.
the right word? Where they kind of fold their wings.
That's right.
And gain speed. And then you got to, well, that happens after you walk in and flush the birds, right?
The timing, depending on the species and the kind of hawk you have, yes. Yeah,
but you think about that, the amount of time to train the dog to not just be to point and to hold, but I mean that dog cannot creep,
yeah,
because you got to deal with falcon too, you know.
It's
then you've trained this falcon, and I mean it is that it's just a harmony of being in partnership, not just with a dog but with a bird on the hunt. I just think that's incredible.
And I'll tell you, I got a friend in Idaho where I live, Paul Michu. He's a big falconer and he's big time in conservation community in Idaho. He's, I think, 78 years old. He's taken 3 sage grouse with his falcon this year.
Really?
And without a dog. His dog was killed. It was hit by a car last fall. And still, at age 78, he's out there beating the sagebrush on his own, putting his bird up and catching 3 sage grouse.
Wow.
Heroic. It's a lifestyle.
Yeah.
It is a lifestyle. You do not like say, hey, I'd like to try, you know, falconry one day. No, that's not it.
Yeah, you got to have, what is it, a mew?
The muse, where you keep the ant. Yeah. But I'll tell you, the most incredible thing to me, I had this Eagle Slim, and we flew her in movies, and I trained her to come to a rabbit lure. She had a little piece 2x4 with a rabbit skin and a rope. And so I cast her off in the sagebrush desert south of Boise, you know, and she'd get up, fly, and circle around. When it came time to call her back, I'd throw my rabbit lure out, and I'd start running through the sagebrush, and I would just run as fast as I can, man. And from 3/4 of a mile out, she'd lock on, she'd pull her wings, and she'd stoop. And I just remember running, looking back right before she'd come in and hit that rabbit lure, and I thought, if I was a rabbit, I would die of fright. It is so powerful.
But when they do, when a falcon hits a sharp tail in the air, if folks have seen Randy Johnson at Sky Dome.
He throws
like 100 mile an hour fastball.
Yes.
And he hits a pigeon. Yeah. And
poofed it. Yeah.
I mean, that's what it looks like,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because they have their talons straight out and just impact is in the talons, right?
It depends. A lot of times, like falcons will punch with their foot first, depending on the size and the speed of the prey. I remember walking in downtown Boise one morning. And all of a sudden, you see kind of some feathers dropping out of the sky, and this peregrine had just smoked a pigeon straight out of the sky. And that one, it just grabbed it and flew, but there's a nesting pair downtown. But yeah, sometimes they'll punch it, and that's when you really see that poof of feathers and this pigeon or sharp-tailed grouse tumbling to the ground, and then they'll land on it and kill it. So.
Well,
awesome.
Labradors. All right, Springers, Labradors. Thank you, Ed, for being very patient.
Oh, no. This has been great. Yeah. I actually have a follow-up on the falcons.
Go for it. Yeah, yeah.
So I think every biologist has kind of a top 10 list of things they've witnessed and seen in the field.
You don't even have to be a biologist.
You're right. It could be a hunter. You're absolutely right. Let's clarify this. It could be anybody.
Yeah.
In my top 10 is watching a peregrine falcon knock a juvenile bald eagle out of the sky.
Wow. Really?
It didn't kill it.
Wow.
Because I watched the eagle land, and he got up later, but it knocked the hell out of him because they're very territorial.
Huh.
That was pretty special.
I had a prairie hit my golden eagle once.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, for the first time in 30 years, I do not have a Labrador Retriever.
Okay.
I got my first one back in December of 1991, and I've had him for well over 30 years.
Oh, well.
And so chocolate light, and I got chocolates. Started up a little kennel about the time Bill Clinton was president, so Buddy made me a hell of a lot of money. The Chocolate Lab was one of the most, popular dogs. But, yeah, I like Patrick, I the very first experience I had and why I went with a lab, a friend of mine took me duck hunting, and it's too long to tell the story, but I grew up hunting from age 10 on, but never with a bird dog.
Mm.
It was always, kicking them up yourself and doing some self-retrieving, and we'll leave that for another time. There was a fun story behind why I decided to buy a dog. When you retrieve your own birds, it gets a little interesting at times. You can imagine how that might look. But I went out hunting for the first time, formal duck hunt with decoys, the works. And I watched this guy work in a trained Chesapeake, and I was absolutely fascinated. Mm. But I also knew the aura around Chesapeakes. I'm like, boy, I want a dog like that, but I think I'm going to get a lab. The funny part is I get a chocolate lab female, and she was more stubborn than any Chesapeake I think I've ever met. So I got a little payback there. But just that fascination with training and the control and I got into AKC hunt testing, had a dog that passed the Master National a couple of times. I judged the Master National, and labs were my thing for a long time. I put my last one down out of the lines I was breeding in March this year.
Okay.
And I haven't replaced him yet, but I will. But right during the COVID period in April, I picked up a poodle pointer.
Wow.
And so I switched gears.
Yeah.
Well, I've always been fascinated by a pointing dog. I've actually, my dogs were always in control enough that I could hunt them in tandem with a pointing dog because they weren't going to break and go blow birds.
You could heal them when a dog went
absolutely. Or set them at a distance on a whistle, which is real handy
it
too.
It is, no doubt.
And so I always had a fascination with pointing dogs, but I got really intrigued by poodle pointers because they haven't really been taken over in the show arena or agility arena or anything like that with AKC. They're pure hunting, and they're brown, so I kept my brown dog theme. So, interestingly enough, the one I got is a slick coat. So he kind of looks like a lab that got his tail caught in the door or something. But I like the poodle pointer a lot, and I'll get another lab down the road. So
Wildlife Society, do you have any projection of what the most popular breed of dogs
absolutely
in your
not.
Community? No idea.
I'll put it on the list of questionnaires when we survey our members, but I bet it's probably 50-50 if I had to take an educated guess.
Cool.
I have to tell you my favorite dog name, though, because this is a very lab thing. with marking and handling and such. The favorite dog name I've ever heard is a field trialer from California. I can't quite remember his name, but I remember that dog like it was yesterday. The full AKC dog's name was Can't Mark, Won't Handle. And he was a FCA, AFC, and I think he might have even gotten an AFC, you know, a national amateur. But anyway, that was, I always thought that was really
Can't
funny.
Can't Mark, Won't Handle.
Regarding the judging, obviously you've got to be really into the breed of choice, mm-hmm. probably have a little OCD yeah. around it, but... You know, I judged a trial 2 weeks ago in Missouri, judging one at the beginning of April in Minnesota and then Montana. One of the reasons I love judging is because it gets me so excited about the world of possibilities about, you know, I mean, my dogs are pretty successful trial dogs and in place in nationals, but I always walk away and think, man, I wish my dogs did that little thing or that little thing. Mm. And I actually find it inspiring, and it continues to refresh my enthusiasm for the breed, because you get to see so many dogs and so many incredible dogs. And so there's something to that, like I said, it's not for everyone, but it just keeps me excited about the dogs themselves. Mm. In that,
well, I became a better handler. I mean,
absolutely.
You're in that judge's yep. seat, or yep. you don't even have to judge. If you just want to work the line with the judges, taking birds from, you know, the judge and that kind of thing, just watching handlers, and it's nothing against the handlers, but they make mistakes all the time.
Or do cool things all the time.
Or do really great things and get themselves out of trouble. So you really learn about how teamwork plays out when you're sitting in that chair watching other dogs. It made me a better handler
totally
than my
agree.
Dog.
Yeah.
So I want to change the question from dogs to sitting in the chair a little bit. Like, how do you got to your position, whether it be executive director, CEO? Because I think you're all biologists by training. And, okay, I got a head shake. So we'll start with you, Patrick, that you're not. But give us your background, what you did for school and what you did up to the point of joining BHA.
Sure, without going through the whole resume, but had a lot of experience with conservation policy, was a legislative and policy director for a statewide organization, development, fundraising, nonprofit management. Probably most notable, I was the director of Vermont's Fish and Wildlife Agency.
And that's why I thought you were a biologist.
Yeah.
But you weren't as the director.
Nope, I wasn't. You know what I found, too, really interesting is that, and, you guys know this as well, is that a lot of state directors ascend through the departments, or agencies as biologists. And when you get there, or at least from my perspective, I found is, like, there were biologists that had this stuff covered, right? I mean, you can mm-hmm. ask the right questions, but it's an external affairs job. It's a legislative relations job. It's a, constituent, an outreach job. I mean, it's a communications job. There's a lot of things that go with that, too. And
not skill sets that all biologists are good at either.
Some of them are.
Some are.
But it's interesting when you look at the diversity of background and resumes for, the directors, and it's not all as predictable as you think. But, mm-hmm. I would totally understand that, And I think at the time I was the youngest state director in the country at the time, at least for a year or two. And then so that's the background. But, again, nonprofit management, too. And then, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, it's my jam, both from a mission perspective and I think the community as well. So many of my best bird hunting spots, they're on public land, state and federal land. I love the idea of getting away from everything and everybody, to those more wild places. And, my favorite cover is not for the faint at heart. I mean, it is just a slog to get back in there, but it's full of birds if you're willing to take the time.
Is this in Pennsylvania,
this is
Vermont?
The one I'm talking about is in Vermont, way up against the Canadian border.
So when you say cover, you're talking rough grouse woods.
Rough grouse woods, yeah. Okay. Grouse and woodcock, I mean, when I lived in Montana, we, pretty much exclusively pheasant hunted, a few huns here and there. But where I'm at now, you know, it's wild grouse and woodcock that come through. Kind of like, you know, upper Midwest, Minnesota, yeah. Wisconsin, Michigan. Certainly a lot of other places as well.
Too. How long have you been in the role at BHA now?
So I'm just over a year under my belt. So started the beginning of last January. Ted here was the chair of the board who invited me into the role. So there's a lot of transferable background, I think, because what's required of, you know, as you guys all know, of the job is a pretty diverse skill set, you know, understanding everything from, you know, management and development and comms and, yep. you know, just kind of everything that goes into that, too, was a good fit. Plus the, you know, the mission and I think the community, you know, it's very passionate and, you know, collaborative, but there's also, you know, a lot younger, which I may not be, but I like to think of myself that way. And then, you know, there's also this edge of irreverence that is definitely a part of my DNA, too. So yeah. It just, you know, everything about it fit me really well. So take the skill sets I managed to collect along the way and, you know, the mission and the community and where I love to go do my own thing when I'm not at work. It was just a great match.
Right on. Ted, I know you're a biologist, right, by training. So tell us through your overview of your resume, how you got to the executive director role.
Well, I grew up in Connecticut, just outside of New York City. My dad took the train to Manhattan every day for 30 years. 16 years old, I know I want to be a biologist, but I never want to work for the government. And my dad told me this story, conservative Republican household. My dad told me the story as to why it was okay if I worked for the government. I said, fine, state agencies, wouldn't it be cool if there was some federal fish and game? Mm-hmm. That's who I want to work for, and I want to live and work on the West. I was reading Ted Trueblood's stories in Field & Stream magazine and just falling in love with the West. And so I thought I'd love to live in the West and work for some fictional federal fish and game and have a beautiful wife and 2.3 children. And I'm happy to report that I have lived the dream. Mm. There is a federal fish and game. It's called the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I got my undergrad in Connecticut, master's at Idaho State University, and started the very next morning after I had defended my master's thesis, started with the Fish and Wildlife Service in Idaho and worked there for 20-some-odd years, 5 years in Nevada, 3 years in New Mexico in a regional office, and then retired and moved back to Idaho, and I retired. And the chairman of the board of the Grouse Partnership said, hey, do you want to apply for our executive director job? And I said, no, only if it's a CEO job. No, I'm kidding. he said, do you want to apply for our executive director job? And I thought to myself, no. And here I am,
right? Because and how many years ago is that?
I cannot. I just realized last night, Bob, somebody asked me, freaking years. I cannot believe it. And what I realized, and this I've encountered this other points in life, if I didn't do it, who would? Mm. Grass hands are the most threatened ecosystem on the continent and in the world. And every day we wake up when we lose a few more grasslands, a few more opportunities to hunt upland birds, a few more opportunities to hunt pronghorn. And we've got to stop that loss. And so I agreed to it, and here I am, and I'm absolutely loving it, working with some really special, heroic landowners, rancher conservationists who believe in conservation every bit as strongly as you and I and anyone listening to this podcast does. And it's just been a pleasure and an honor to work with these folks to try to, you know, we've been doing a great job for decades, like slowing the loss of grasslands, mm-hmm. like with Farm Bill Conservation Title programs. But the vision of these ranchers and the Grouse Partnership is to stop and reverse the losses and restore grasslands.
So I'm going to come back to that. That's my next question is for you each to give kind of an overview of your organizations.
Okay.
Before we get into the kind of the meat of the Alta Leopold.
You see me, you get me fired up.
I know. That's good. That's good. We're gonna jump to Ed, Wildlife Society, CEO. I'm assuming you're a biologist then as the head of the Wildlife Society. What's your background?
So I'm going to tell a little bit of a childhood story on why I became a biologist. I think most of us are old enough to remember that show, Marlon, with Marlon Perkins,
Mutual of Omaha's
Wild Kingdom. So I met Marlon Perkins. He was the curator. He was kind of like the contemporary Jack Hanna of the St. Louis Zoo. And I met him when I was 8 years old, broke away from my mom holding me and ran over and started talking to him. I watched that show religiously, and I said, yeah, I want to do what those guys do. Hmm. Largely Stan Brock and Jim Fowler. And I said, that's what I want to do. Hmm. But I didn't really know what it was. But I wasn't one of those kids that said, I want to be a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, whatever. Like, no, I want to do that. whatever that is, and I never deviated. So I grew up about 300 miles from here, north of St. Louis.
Really?
Looked over that destiny menu at a high school and went, yeah, I think I'm going to go west as a young man, follow the Horace Greeley advice. So I went to school at a little school in Colorado, got a natural resources degree, then continued with a wildlife degree, master's, worked on bighorn sheep, really living the dream there because I love those creatures. And I thought I was going to be a big game biologist, but then I started my professional career in Oregon and worked for Fish and Wildlife Service, Forest Service, did a stint with timber industry as a research scientist for a while, and then went back and got a PhD. And, yeah, I've just been kind of doing the science and management thing for a long while. And then I took a jump to the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, which is where I started meeting a lot of your colleagues, and got into the policy space. And that all of that kind of built my resume to do what I do now. I've been a member of the Wildlife Society since 1984.
Wow.
And, you know, it's been my community, my people, my network. And I was about ready to part ways with TRCP and go to teach at Colorado State full time. I'd been teaching part time. I thought, yeah, I think it's time to give something back. Try to be a decent role model for impressionable youth, shed a little experience. And I saw this job come open, and I thought, what a great way to cap your career.
Yeah.
Been a member for, you know, 40 years, and I absolutely love it. It's going to be how I capstone my career. I'll probably teach a little bit into retirement, but now this is I love what I'm doing.
So I mentioned earlier that I don't recall us ever meeting before. Right.
Right? We've known of each other, I think.
Right. Your name for me does connect with TRCP, and it connects with sage grouse.
Yeah.
That's when, you know, when we dove into Sage Grouse Initiative, it was very similar time frame to when you were doing that work with TRCP. So that your name is synonymous in my brain.
And that's how I met Ted, actually, is when he was, you know, with the Fish and Wildlife Service.
So you guys all have known, well, you talked about, essentially, Ted, you've hired, right, Patrick. So you guys, this is a very incestuous sort
of podcast. It's a small profession, trust me.
I didn't think about it that way until about 20 minutes ago, but you're right.
Well, it's funny. You get to talking to people, whether they're in range or forestry or wildlife, they're going to know somebody that knew you.
And oh, yeah.
It's a very tight profession. I always teach my students or young professionals, it's like, careful the bridges you burn, because you'll be walking over them again at some point, trust me.
So where I want to go from here, and this is kind of a fun, different concept for the podcast, right? I've picked out some all the Leopold quotes that I want you guys to react to. But I want you to do that with the listeners knowing kind of the lens with which you're looking at it. So before I read the quotes, I'm going to have you tell, like in Patrick's case, you know, tell a little bit about BHA's mission and what you're trying to accomplish. Ted, you can come back to the grasslands, right? Talk about North American Grouse Partnership. And then we'll go through the quotes and folks can see, you know, what's resonating with you in those quotes. Because one of the things that, you know, I'm not a biologist by training. I'm marketing in English. But Leopold has had equal impact on my life as an English major as many biologists, I believe. Just being able to read Leopold's words through Sand County Almanac and see how he looked at the world and think about he wrote this stuff 80 years ago now, you know? And it's so true still today in so many ways. I mean, you know, Nostradamus is known as the great, you know, seer of the future. And, you know, unfortunately, in many cases, Aldo Leopold was the seer of the future.
He was so far ahead of his time.
It's unbelievable.
And long before the concepts in modern ecology now, he was saying it back in the 30s.
So that's where I want to go. Before we jump into that, a shout out to one of our great partners, Onyx. Onyx works with pretty much every organization in the conservation world. They're a national sponsor of Pheasants Forever, and quail forever. You're probably thinking about turkey season as you listen to this podcast. You can get Onyx membership and get 20% off if you go to the show notes, click on the link, it'll take you to Onyx, and use the code PFQF to get that 20% off on your membership, and Onyx will make a contribution to our wildlife habitat mission. All right, give us the elevator speech, if you will, Patrick, on backcountry hunters and anglers. What's your mission? What's on your mind? How do you view the world?
I'll talk about how I think BHA views the world. You know, but obviously there's a lot of alignment because that's how I ended up there in the first sure. place. But backcountry hunters and anglers is the voice for public lands, waters, and wildlife, which I think, as we know, is a pretty high-profile issue right now. I think there's a lot of concerns about the future of our public lands. I think we have a lot of distinctive strengths. And what I appreciate is that our peer organizations like PFQF are, you know, recognize that we all have this role to play, and that when we, you know, the synergy of playing off of what each of us do is kind of the 1 + 1 + 1 = 10. You know, mm-hmm. like we're more additive. And some of the strengths. First of all, we have 45 chapters in 49 states, and it's an incredibly passionate, engaged, in many cases, a lot younger demographic. I mean, most of our members are under the age of 50, and you know, when I stopped in on this big long road trip that I did around parts of the Southeast and Midwest, I mean, you know, some of the chapters had, you know, these amazing, amazing people in their 20s and 30s, which those are your future conservation advocates. One of the really distinctive parts of our mission is that because we're about public lands, waters, and wildlife, it encompasses a lot of different things, right? So, you know, whether you're a steelhead fisherman in Washington or an alligator hunter in Georgia or a pheasant hunter in Minnesota or a pronghorn hunter in North Dakota, you're all part of the same tribe. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard folks across the BHA universe, no matter where they live, say, when I ran into the BHA folks, I knew that I had found my people, right? Even if they had completely different ways of, you know, engaging in hunting and fishing and whatever outdoor-based recreation that they did, there's also a high degree of autonomy and independence at the chapter level, in the state level. It's a bit of a choose-your-own-adventure when it comes to the work that they do, policy engagement, stewardship work, outstanding mentorship programs, etc. And in a lot of states, because there's that autonomy to engage, our chapters can dig right into key policy issues. You know, last year in Kansas, you know, here we are in Kansas City right now, you know, there was a bill that basically would have privatized wildlife. And our Kansas leadership didn't need approval from, you know, HQ to go get engaged. And I mean, I watched the YouTube recording of this testimony, and I was just blown away by the ability of our volunteer chapter leaders in a state that has, I believe, the second least amount of public land of any state.
Yeah, it's 49th out of 50. I think it's by percentage.
Yep, absolutely. Yep. By percentage. Absolutely hit a grand slam on eloquently talking about the seven tenets of the North American model of conservation and why this bill would have been bad for hunters, bad for wildlife, bad for habitat. And they just did an amazing job. I mentioned that example because here we are, but in so many states I hear from legislative leaders, from fish and wildlife personnel at state and federal level, nobody's able to move the needle like the BHA advocates because they have that passion, that enthusiasm, and they have this feeling like they know they can make a difference when they show up in force and, you know, talk about conservation, public lands, wildlife, hunting and fishing opportunities. It's just the coolest thing. I mean, I get inspired by our chapters every day. Our newsletter just came out last week, and I'm looking through it, and I was just thinking, nobody outside of the BHA community would believe all the amazing, cool stuff that happens every single day in our chapter. So I think it's that passion, that engagement, that autonomy, that focus on something broader than, say, a single species or assemblage of species or habitat type that really sets us apart. And that autonomy and our willingness to, you know, play David to Goliath at times and having the courage of our convictions is something that I think folks in our broader community have, you know, come to rely on. And, you know, I think that we have a very enduring role in the future of conservation in a lot of ways, I believe, because of our demographics, that BHA represents the future of conservation in our space.
Yeah, when I think about BHA, I also think it's sort of a clap back to the theory that volunteerism is dead in the next generation, right? Because there's, you know, there some generation just kind of got tired of going to the banquet system, right? And BHA has kind of been built on the, well, here's an opportunity to get your fingernails dirty and go do something. And that's volunteerism in its purest form. And all the other organizations, I think about ours, we've learned from that. You know, we've always had volunteers that do habitat work and different things. But, you know, then we, over time, well, let's do the banquet, raise the funds,
sure,
right?
Sure.
Now we have Hands-on Habitat Month that's back to the basics, right? Like, let's pull the barbed wire. Let's do the brush removal. Maintain the grasslands, right? But I think that's an enduring reminder that BHA has brought to all of us, is like, get the fingernails dirty. Volunteerism isn't dead. You just have to tap back into the right motivations.
I think that's right. I always tell people, you know, we all go through life with our working philosophies on things. Yeah. And, you know, the world is run by people who show up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, BHA people show up. And, you know, when we're working on a stewardship project on, you know, a piece of state or federal land, it's remarkable how many people show up to get their – but great way to put it, Bob, you know, get their fingernails dirty. And, you know, you look at this, it's just a lot younger group of people. I also – just say one more thing, too. I also think, you know, we could learn something from, you know, I guess the banquet model, because sometimes people want to celebrate in a little bit more high style. Mm. I mean, it's a little antithetical to the, sort of like the whole vibe of the BHA community. But, you know, we have pint nights, right? And so there's an incredibly low barrier to entry. All you need is $5 and you're in. And I can't tell you how many people I run into, you know, in our community that they never hunted or they hadn't even heard of BHA. But their buddy was going to a pint night, and they were like, well, I can do that.
Right.
It's important to reiterate, we all have a role to play. I appreciate how much we integrate our work together. I mean, the conservation work of PFQF is pretty incredible. And, you know, I mean, I'm in touch with and just have so much respect for President, you know, CEO Marilyn Vetter is just amazing. And that's, you know, I think that right there, you know, BHA and PFQF, I mean, like, you know, just working together, even if there isn't a specific project, but talking about where we're at, where we're going, the future of conservation, the things that we need to do, and, you know, batting around ideas is as valuable as anything. So I do value the synergy of our broader community in ways that we don't often get to talk about. But, man, with you fine gentlemen here, it's a good time to do that and be reminded of that.
We'll bounce to North American Grouse Partnership. I framed it as an elevator story that I kept plugging Patrick for questions.
Yeah.
But
downtown Manhattan for that mission.
Give us the
40 floors.
North American Grouse Partnership's mission and overview.
Well, maybe if I can provide a segue from BHA just for a second.
Sure.
One other note. I just, again, stepped off the board after 10 years, just 2 months ago did that. One of the things about BHA I think is really special is it's famously nonpartisan, one-third independent, one-third Republican, one-third Democratic. And in some ways, is, you know, BHA is what America was at one time, especially in the conservation field. And I think that gestalt bears reminding ourselves of. You know, the reason why the people are in the room there together is they're there for the love, you know, the love of wildlife and their habitats. That's really neat. And the same thing can be said about the Grouse Partnership. I mean, the love of grasslands, you know, the love of conservation in general, taking on some of the biggest challenges. And I've already alluded to the fact that, you know, grasslands are the most threatened ecosystem on the continent and in the country. 11 years ago, you could legally hunt lesser prairie chickens, and they're listed under the Endangered Species Act. I could, you know, shoot 2 sage grouse a day in Idaho several years ago, and today I got to draw a permit, like an elk tag. Mm-hmm. I got to draw it if I want to shoot 2 sage grouse in an entire season. So, and this is happening on our watch, on Hunters and Anglers watch. And the other example I love to give is, how long is it, you know, pronghorn are declining significantly in the Great Plains, you know, in some parts, especially mm-hmm. the southwestern Great Plains, where it overlaps with lesser prairie chickens. How long before we're not going to be able to hunt pronghorn in the southwestern Great Plains anymore? Pronghorn are already listed under the Endangered Species Act in Arizona. Are we going to let that happen in the southwestern Great Plains and elsewhere? Mm-hmm. Every day we wake up and we're failing to take ownership, and that's what the Grouse Partnership's all about. Our mission is saving grouse and their habitats, especially prairie grouse, because the need is so urgent. And so the question that we're challenged with is, how do we create this sense of urgency? Do we wake up tomorrow morning and say, oh my gosh, grasslands are the most threatened ecosystem on the continent and the world, let's go? Well, we could, but that was true yesterday and it's going to be true tomorrow too. Mm-hmm. So why now? And the reason why now is that rather than taking a hand-wringing, sky-is-falling approach, what the Grouse Partnership is doing is we're reaching out to landowners who own prairie grouse habitat and who have the same dedication to conservation as we do. For lesser prairie chickens, which again were recently listed under the Endangered Species Act, they're on the tip of the spear and they're our
focus.
Which
was the first time we had you on the podcast.
Yeah.
It was a lesser prairie
chicken
episode.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
2 years ago, roughly?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. And that was the second time they were listed. They were listed in the 20-teens, delisted by a judge. Yep. But what we said is, so 90% of lesser prairie chicken habitat is privately owned. Okay. And, you know, so this gets to BHA's public lands, waters, and wildlife. It's not public land, but it is public wildlife. And I was at the Kansas BHA event 2 nights ago, 135 awesome humans, you know, trying to figure out how to save public wildlife on private lands. And the way to do that is through the courageous leadership of this group of rancher conservationist heroes who have the courage to call themselves the Lesser Prairie Chicken Landowner Alliance. Mm. They're not afraid of the fact that they were just listed under the Endangered Species Act. They love wildlife. They love conservation. They want prairie chickens to stick around. And they're multi-generational ranching families who are willing to put their money where their mouth is.
So explain that and what they're trying to do, because a lot of folks will think about, you know, the previous thought process with when a species was listed as threatened or endangered on your property. The modus operandi was shoot, shovel, and shut up.
That's right.
Don't deal with the problem.
That's right.
This is a polar opposite approach to it from a landowner's perspective.
And they can't help it because they love wildlife and grasslands and conservation just like the rest of us. Hmm. They cannot help themselves, and they're courageous humans. And that's why they're giving us this urgent opportunity to stop and reverse the loss of grasslands.
Go ahead.
Well, and so that's where it comes from. And the question is, how do we do that? And
mm-hmm. I can. So you posed that question before we even started recording.
Yeah.
How do we make grasslands relevant beyond the bird hunting community, beyond the public lands community? That's the big question, right? What do you have a theory on why people, the general public, takes grasslands for granted?
Well, it's flyover country. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to visit. Hmm. How many places, how many national parks do we have dedicated to grasslands? Theodore Roosevelt National Park, I don't know, maybe is there another one?
Not very many.
and so
there are national grasslands.
National grasslands.
13 national grasslands?
Yeah. But even those can be hard to visit, some mm-hmm. of them.
Right.
They don't even have visitor facilities. They hardly even show up on a map. Some better
remote.
Than others. And so people, when they drive, say, from the East Coast out west to see national parks, grasslands are not on their list. Mm-hmm. Now, what's really happening there is, if you look at the purpose of the Endangered Species Act and the mission of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, that the job of the people in that agency is to conserve the ecosystems upon which we and all other species depend. Mm. And if you look at grasslands, you know that the U.S. beef herd is at its lowest point since 1952. You know that rural communities suffered a decade-long population decline for the first time in the 20-teens. We lose 2 million acres of grasslands in the Great Plains every single year. This is a human story. This is a story about what we're losing in terms of ability to produce food and sustain rural communities. And in water, healthy grasslands store up to 66% more water than bare ground in the form of a feedlot or anything else. So these are the argument. This is the urgent opportunity and why people should care. We care about clean water. We care about our healthy communities. We care about being able to produce beef here in this country. That's the reason.
So I haven't gotten to the Wildlife Society, so I'm going to deviate from the plan a second because you posed a big question. Why do we take grasslands for granted? And so I'm thinking about all the Leopold quote. It's the fourth one I had on this list. Yeah,
I was thinking the same thing when he said, "Yes, I was."
Okay, yeah. so here's the quote. So Ed, we'll get back to you. I apologize, but the fourth quote I have listed is our ability to perceive quality in nature begins, as in art, with the pretty. It expands through successive stages of the beautiful to values and yet uncaptured by language. And as I was thinking about this, so are you tracking with me so far?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think so.
I read that quote, and when I wrote it in here for us to riff off of, honestly, I was thinking about desert quail hunting. And, you know, I'm a youper. Native youper, grew up in the Northwoods.
We'll make fun of you later on.
Hold my beer. I'm going to try something here.
Yeah.
So I always had this impression of the desert being an absolute wasteland. Nothing lives. You know, there was no value to it. Just sand and cactus and nothing was there. And then I went to Arizona on a scaled quail and Gamble's quail hunt with my dog. And I followed my dog into the desert, and I thought, holy cow, this is alive. There is so much value of wildlife and habitat and different plants that I thought it was ugly, and now it's beauty. And this is the human condition in my mind. This is like, we're such visual creatures. We can love mountains, and we can love forests, and we can love and grasslands. They're not necessarily as visual. You know, you got to immerse yourself in them, which you are alluding to. You got to be in them to see the beauty, to see the wildlife. You miss the visual unless you're actually in them.
Your story about desert quail is an exact parallel to my story about grasslands. It's not just flyover country. It's also drive-through country. Mm. And I didn't really understand until I actually, you know, started – you know, years ago, pheasant and quail hunting in Kansas, particularly western Kansas, too. If you don't walk the landscape, you have no idea how incredible it is. I think it's a great way to put it. It's alive, right? And every little, you know, rivulet and swale and some kind of change in feature in the landscape that you can't see from your car or the airplane is alive with something. They're like those edges. Even you know, when you get the areas of, you know, agriculture where you especially with, you know, circular irrigation systems, you know, you still end up with those corners full of life, right? Anything that's left alone is just, it's remarkable.
Well, and you mentioned rivulets and, right? It's water, right?
It's the coolest thing, right? And I had the same experience. And I also have felt for a long time that, you know, it wasn't bad intentions, but man, we have brought up a few generations of what I refer to as aesthetic environmentalists, right? It looks pretty, so it must be, you know, healthy, as opposed to ecological environmentalists, where, you know, sometimes Mother Nature is kind of a mess, right? I mean, you know, if you think about grouse and woodcock habitat is like, you know, I didn't intend this, but I was quoted in Gun Dog magazine saying, good grouse habitat is so thick you can't throw a dead cat through it. So apologies to cat owners. It wasn't my intention to. But no, but I mean.
Thank you, Callie Parmalee, for that one.
Right. So, you know, we have got to make sure that we not only disconnect ourselves from what our perceptions are about what healthy habitat is, we also have to recognize that there's this disconnect from people that don't spend time on the landscape, because that was me And sounds like that was you, Bob, you know, and until I actually got on the landscape and experienced what you're talking about, Ted, right? That the vibrancy and what we're losing is something you have to experience firsthand to really get it.
That was the vision of Leopold that we talked about earlier when I mentioned he was so far ahead of his time. When we came up with concepts about ecosystem management and biodiversity, he was so far ahead. And what I embody in that quote is the interconnectedness and understanding all of the things that produce whatever that might be, clean water, food,
right,
all the things that people don't see until they really understand that it is alive and how that all connects to it. Together.
How does that resonate for you, Ted?
Amen, brothers.
Yeah.
Amen.
Well, it's also grasslands. You know, some of the messaging we use in the North American Grasslands Conservation Act, which everybody around the room is part of that effort. Some of the messaging is that grasslands are in every backyard in America, and not backyards per se, but sagebrush. Everglades or glades, prairies, you know, grassland is an all-encompassing umbrella term that speaks to places in Iowa and Idaho, right?
Yeah.
Southeast, you know, savannas, it's everywhere.
And the other thing is it's the easiest thing to develop. Here's one of my issues. If you're a wind energy developer and you look at a map, the place you want to put your wind tower is right in the middle of prairie grouse habitat.
Right.
They know nothing about prairie grouse, but it's just the conditions match up so well. Right. And it's like, there's no trees. You know, it's remote, and it's not very expensive to buy per acre. What a great place to put a wind farm.
And it's not going to impact anything.
There's nothing there.
Right.
There's nothing there.
It's funny. I want to mention sagebrush because you brought it up. An interesting story. I was over in southeast Oregon. And talking to a guy that was an interpreter, or he was a nature interpreter.
Gotcha.
Is what his job was at the Malheur Refuge. And he had gotten out of prison years and years earlier and was driving through this part of south central Oregon. And for those of you that have been there, that's as drive-through as it gets. It's sagebrush for endless, endless miles. And I remember him telling a story that he stopped, I think it was in French Glen, Oregon, and, you know, he was getting gas, and he just was commenting how ugly this place was. And the guy pumping his, somebody pumps your gas in Oregon, still to this day, I think. The guy says, oh, no, son, you got to understand, this is the most beautiful landscape out there ever. You just got to go out and experience it and walk through it. And apparently he did. And he had a revelation, and he never left. And, you know, built himself. I think he had various positions, but he told that story, and it resonated pretty well with kind of what we're talking about.
Yeah, very similar.
That's a great story about how grassland.
Yep.
Well, I've prevented you.
Want to go backwards now?
Yeah, I apologize. But
Leopold in here
It was a natural time to interject. Yeah. Tell us about the Wildlife Society.
So we're a 501c3 nonprofit, as our other organizations are here. We're the professional society of wildlife biologists. Think of us as the trade association of wildlife professionals and students. Have about 11,000 members, and that makes up researchers, managers, academia, students, any professional typically. And we have an open society too. You're not a biologist, you can be a member. You can join us.
How many members is it?
Right, it varies, but we're hovering between about 10,500 and 11,000, so, which to me is too few. I can't fathom there aren't more biologists out there that would want to be part of us. And, you know, we're always making our pitch to join the Wildlife Society. This is your network. These are your people. These are the folks that you can learn from and teach. And so I've been a member for, like I said, since 1984. Our mission just changed. It's empowering wildlife professionals to advance conservation through science, community, and professional excellence. That's my 1 to 2 floor part.
There you go.
If you gave me 4 or 5 floors, I would tell you that we started, I think all of us know the North American wildlife conference that began in 1936. In fact, I think we're all going there after this, at least some of us. Maryland's going and others. Yep.
Big team.
Yeah. The very first one was in Washington, D.C. in 1936. That's where we formed as the Society of Wildlife Professionals. The very next one, just a few hundred miles from here, over in St. Louis at the second wildlife conference, we changed our name to the Wildlife Society, and we've been called that ever since. And Aldo Leopold, the father of wildlife management, the first professor of wildlife management at the University of Wisconsin, he and colleagues were trying to decide, well, should we break away from the ecological societies, form our own? And after much contemplation, they decided they would break. So Leopold was a founder of the Wildlife Society back in the 30s. And the colleagues that he was working with in this developing and emerging profession called wildlife management. And back then, it was very game-focused. His first job was professor of game management, and he wrote a beautiful piece on game management, a book on game management and policy. So he was our he was our third president, too, by the way.
Just just as a note, Leopold did have short hairs, guys.
He does, yeah, a lot of pictures of short hairs. Well, and he does a lot of metaphors with dogs.
All labs are short hairs, Bob.
Oh, really?
Well, they have short hair.
I had to interject.
So that the inception of the Wildlife Society, part of that was we need a scientific journal where we can publish all this emerging literature. So we published the Journal of Wildlife Management, which was our first flagship journal. We now publish three scientific journals and a popular magazine for our members. We hold an annual conference where we bring wildlifers in. We try to move it around the country. We used to be partnered with the North American for a long while, and the idea there was to get these emerging biologist scientist types in front of the policymakers, state agency directors, agency leads, others working at kind of that higher level of policy and such. We did break away back in the mid-1990s. 93 was the last time we met collectively with the North American, and we formed our own conference. But part of that was because there were so many students and researchers at all levels, state, federal, were producing all this work. We felt like we needed our own conference to do our own thing. But at that conference, we provide lots of training opportunities, mentoring, networking, those kinds of things that are very helpful. And now I'm really starting to try to work more with partners like Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, Ducks Unlimited, Turkey Federation, all of them, because we're all identifying different needs on training. Before I sat down with you, I was talking with folks about this need for training skills, those kinds of things. We play a real strong role in that, in training the next generation. We also do some policy work, and we have a certification program to become a certified wildlife biologist, meaning that you have the educational skills, the educational coursework, and you're serving in a professional position for a certain number of years to be a certified biologist. We have also have a certification program for airport, qualified airport biologists, because there's a lot of, you know, interactions with wildlife at airports. This is kind of a new one.
Do every major airport have a biologist on site?
Not all of them, no. But military bases have them as well at times. It just, it's a kind of an emerging issue, obviously, with bird strikes and other other issues. But so that's kind of who we are.
Okay. Biologists, I know there's a common refrain that there's not as many hunters that are biologists nowadays.
It has changed.
Do you measure that? Do you survey your members of biologists and find out what the percentage of them who hunt and fish?
We did a survey a number of years ago. I remember it coming out. I remember filling it out. I didn't look up the numbers for this discussion. But it definitely has shifted, no doubt. I can tell you that I told you a little bit of my story, meeting Marlon Perkins and growing up hunting and fishing. I didn't mention that part, but my grandpa started taking me when I was 5 years old hunting. Then I could legally get a license when I was 10. So I grew up in that era when, you know, it was still probably 90 at least plus of people that became biologists really were hunting and fishing in their in their upbringing through their childhood. That has shifted dramatically. And I think for the better in a lot, in some ways. You get different perspectives, different skill sets, different ideas. But what I worry about is a little bit of a disconnect between active management and sustainable management of wildlife resources. And I think we all know there's been a shift in values that has come with that shift in rural and urban populations. Right. I mean, it's pretty easy to look at that chart that's out there that I could share with you sometime if you haven't seen it. You know, obviously, you go to the 1900s or so, it was 5-10% urban and mostly rural in America, and that's completely done a flip. And that has created a little bit of a disconnect, which I'll talk about at least when we start talking about some more of these quotes. That's created a lot of shifts in not only societal values, but also just that understanding of sustainable wildlife use. And some just don't believe in using wildlife for the sake of using wildlife as for human use.
It shift in a simple two words from conservation to preservation.
Right. Right? Conservation embodies preservation as a component. Mm. That's the way I view it. Mm. Conservation is about... And Roosevelt said this as a quote that, you know, he recognized conservation is as much about, and I'm gonna have to paraphrase here because I can't remember it, but it's as much about preservation and wise use of our resources. He recognized that balance between preservation and the conservation, the wise use of resources. What he didn't appreciate was robbing future generations with mismanaged, unsustainable use. I totally butchered that, but that was the concept that he had embedded in that quote. That conservation is this umbrella with preservation as a piece of the pie, but also wise use.
Okay. All right. The longest tease in podcasting history has talked about all the Leopold quotes a long time ago. So we'll riff off of those now. So I've got a couple more. We've hit on one of them already. Let's go to the first one I have here. Aldo Leopold, right? A peculiar, easy for me to say, a peculiar virtue in wildlife ethics is that the hunter ordinarily has no gallery to applaud or disapprove of his conduct. Or her conduct. Whatever his or her acts, they are dictated by their own conscience rather than a mob of onlookers. It is difficult to exaggerate the importance of this fact. When you hear this, Patrick, how does this apply in your mind to what's going on in 2025?
Well, first of all, I one of the things I always told my two boys when they were growing up, out of all the, you know, there's a lot of things I said at them as much as anything, was, you know, the definition of true character is doing the right thing when no one's watching.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's basically what he's saying here.
Yeah.
I do think that shifted a little bit because of the explosion of social media and what that means. And sometimes it's a good thing. And sometimes, you know, let's be honest, it's a bad thing. And it's, you know, and listen, I believe too, like, you know, context and intention are everything, right? If the context is like, it was the very first pheasant you ever shot and you were with your dad and you got a limit and, you know, your intention is to, you know, put it on your, you know, Instagram or, you know, Facebook page to, cause you, man, it's just an incredible thing, right? You know, that's one thing, but, you know, I mean, when you've got, you know, and I'm not saying that this is, you know, there's a difference between ethics and aesthetics, which is a whole other conversation, yeah. Right?
But they rhyme, but they're not the same.
They are not the same. And you know, the aesthetics of putting, you know, 100 dead coyotes all lined up, you know, on your Facebook page is the easiest thing in the world for, you know, the anti-hunting movement to grab and say, you know, this is what hunting is, where an anecdote becomes an entire culture, mm-hmm. you know, across the country for any different kinds of species. And so I just think we've got to be far more conscious and far more careful. I do not, you know, thumb my nose at folks that, you know, might say that, like, oh, I should be able to do whatever I want. Well, sure, you can, but that'll have consequences too. So, you know, I do think that there has been a shift from the Leopold quote of when you're out there doing your own thing in your own way, and it has this meaning and this level of fulfillment that is something. And I think too often we may do something for everyone else less than ourselves. And I look, I was a fishing guide for a long time, and I mean, I remember, you know, it was in Montana, Western Montana, you know, and I would have, you know, guys who would come out, you know, catch a decent fish, take a photo, and they'd be like, all right, row me out, we're done. I just wanted to show all my buddies back at, you know, the financial office in, you know, Manhattan, like, you know, I can catch a fish. Like, it was never about the fish. It was never about the beauty of the place and the experience. It was about
ego.
It was, look at me, ego, you know, whatever the heck it is too. So, I do feel like there's been a recognition of how we've drifted away from that concept in the Leopold quote and the need to get back to it, because I think we're seeing the consequences of that. And I'm actually really glad you included that, because I think we can all learn something. I'm guilty too, right? I mean, I got to be careful about, you know, being excited about whatever, you know, came home for dinner, and you know, what I do with that. And remember, it's about the experience. It's about the process, right? It's about, you know, it's not the getting, right? Mm-hmm. It's the getting there.
Mm-hmm. There's more to the story than the tailgate.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great way to look at it. Ted, anything you want to add?
I love that, Patrick. That's great. And I would even extend it one more step further. While Leopold was referring to our own personal conduct in the field, and Patrick, you then extended that to intention. In 2025, I think we those of us who engage in, you know, pursuit of game and fish need to really look at ourselves in the mirror and ask, are we doing all that we need to do to ensure that our children's children can do this? And if you can't look at yourself in the mirror and think, you know, I'm not working to ensure that these opportunities continue for generations to come, then that's my latest take on that. And Leopold's context of being alone in the field still applies. You know, Patrick, your extension as to the motivations is great. Yeah, but ultimately, I think we all have an obligation, to the extent that we love wildlife and we love what we do, to make sure that the next generation can do it.
Yeah, well said. Yep. Ed?
Not much to add on that.
Yeah, pretty good.
Well, my answer was basically exactly the same as Patrick's. It, that self-reflection and understanding that whatever you're doing, you should be doing it as if someone's watching, and there's a consequence for every action. And social media has just blown that completely out of the water. That, and I'd say that mentoring, who your mentor was and how you were brought up and taught to hunt. And I'll never forget a story I read in, I think it was Sports Afield, where the guy talked about his young boy went out. And it was one of those scenarios where it got up right between us here, you know, and you shot and I shot. So the kid shot at the same, and he missed, clearly. You know, the wad shoots behind the tail. But the bird drops on his shot, and the dad's father had shot that bird. And the kid, like, threw a tantrum when the guy was claiming that to be his bird. And he went and got the bird and said, this is mine, I shot it, you know. And he took it away from him and took the gun, put him in the truck, and grounded him from, you know, hunting for a long while. But the lesson there was, that's not how we behave. And so it kind of weighs a little bit on who your mentor was. My grandpa did something similar to me when I was younger, and I never forgot it. And I never did anything again like that, you know. It's so, a little bit of that is based on how you were brought up and who your mentors are, and building that sense of ethics. And unfortunately, there's too many folks that and it's not pointing fingers too much, but we got to be careful. There are too many people that I don't think are paying attention to their actions and knowing that there are consequences of that, and the social media just exacerbates that. And I would say, and I know you all know this, it's not just the anti-hunters. There is still a significant amount of America that agrees with or can accept hunting, but they're not hunters. They're not anti. They're not. But you could shift somebody really quickly,
right,
you with
can
one of those social media, really fast. Change them from a benign, agnostic, non-hunter into an anti-hunter pretty fast, just based on that depiction. And it's disrespectful, in my view. And I've done the grip and grins.
Disrespectful of both the rest of us and the wildlife.
Right.
Right.
Right. The wildlife.
So you had to go last, so you get to go first. That's the reaction. Patrick clearly set a wonderful stage with that reaction to that quote. All right. Second quote. I guess third quote now, really. One of my favorites. Maybe Leopold arguably is most famous. I don't know. Maybe it's just in my mind. There are two spiritual dangers in not owning a farm. One is the danger of supposing that breakfast comes from the grocery, and the other that heat comes from the furnace. I just think that this was so profound.
It was.
And it still is today. I mean, so explain what Leopold's saying and what that means to you in 2025.
This is one of my favorite quotes. I use it often in my teaching. I actually teach a class on conservation ethics, which focuses a lot on Leopold. This, to me, embodies exactly what we're seeing today with social values changing. The disconnect, long before Richard Louv, his
Last
book,
Child,
Last Child in the Wood, long before that, this was one of Leopold's greatest fears. And what he's saying there is this disconnect between people and nature and the understanding. All of these quotes are interconnected. But to me, this is the one that's most profound because it describes so succinctly. It's a thinker for some, but it describes so succinctly how detached many of in our society have become that they really don't understand where food comes from or where heat comes from and what the consequences are when you manipulate habitats, when you develop in the wrong places, when something isn't sustainable, all of these things. That's part of our job now, and I think it's one of our more important jobs. It gets at that why it matters question. I tell my students and any young biologist or anybody that has, it's like, you better have right on the tip of your tongue that one floor elevator speech on why it matters. If somebody asks you, Ted, why should I care about Lesser Prairie Chickens, you better not stutter. Because now you've lost them. And it's like, he doesn't really know. He's making something up now. But you got to make it relate to people so they start understanding this interconnectedness and why these things are so important to them. But I think that's exactly embodies what he was getting at, that disconnect that we're seeing.
What's your reaction, Ted?
So many years ago, I went to a friend's house to visit with he and his wife, both non-hunters. My friend knew I liked to hunt, asked me about hunting, so I talked about it. And his wife listened intently. And then she stood up to head into the kitchen to put dinner on the table, and she said, well, I don't think hunting's right. And then we all went into the dining room and sat down to plates of veal. Yeah, which, for those who don't know, is tortured baby calf. And it just struck me, you know, it just struck me how disconnected she was, and a very intelligent, wonderful human being. And I thought, if she can be that disconnected, God help us, really. And so I love that quote from Leopold. It says it all. Here I am. That was 40 years ago that happened to me. And yet here we are today. I think even more people are more disconnected. And so not sure what to say about it except that it's prescient.
Yeah.
Prescient.
Anything you want to add, Patrick?
I ended up, you know, after I was at the department, I was on the Fish and Wildlife Board in Vermont, which sets regulations for hunting, fishing, and trapping. And it was right about the time that a lot of the pretty hardcore, extreme anti-hunting activists showed up and, you know, had similar stories of what you're, you know, telling. There was just a wild disconnect, right? I mean, you know, the anti-intellectual bent was kind of crazy making, you know, like you believe in the science of climate change, but you don't believe in the science of wildlife management and conservation, you know, through hunting as, you know, partners with, you know, state and federal agencies. And there was just this miss. And, you know, I was quoted, but wasn't as bad as it did. Cat won. I didn't get myself in trouble. No, and I you know, said, you know, I strongly believe that hunting is the most socially, ethically, and environmentally responsible way to put meat on your table. Mm-hmm. Go ahead and tell me I'm wrong. And she couldn't. Right? Because you are taking ownership. There's a high degree of self-reliance and pride. You're harvesting animals that live off of the natural landscape. And if you protect the natural systems, it's the highest degree of biodiversity on those landscapes as well. Rather than changing the landscape, you know, even when you're growing vegetables, even, you know, organic, you're still, you know, plowing under every critter that's out there. And if you want to look at this from a non-emotional, intellectual perspective, I really do believe that hunting is the most remarkable way to take ownership and feed yourself. And that quote about the disconnect in our society is embodied in the lack of understanding. Ted, your story. I've got so many similar stories like that. And, you know, anyway, I mean, I while it's easy for me to roll my eyes, and I definitely do, I also think that there's an opportunity for people willing to have a conversation, you know, so we're, you know, like, so what do you eat? Like, you know, do you know where that comes from? And, you know, I mean, you know, you go down that road. I mean,
sure.
We all know what I'm talking about, but
I everything resonates with me. I think about, you know, the person, family going into the Cub Foods or whatever the grocery store is in your Kroger and buying the package of chicken in the styrofoam, chicken breasts. And there is no concept, just like your veal example, no concept to that chicken breast or thigh to an actual living animal, let alone a connection to the animal living off the land, eating water, having food. It's zero connections, which heartens me with, you know, in the last 20 years, say the locavore movement in hunting, you know, we've always talked about filling our freezer. Do you get your elk? Did you get your deer, right? It's always been largely about the food in the hunting community, but it's been better in the media, I think, with the advent of the Hank Shaws and the Jesse Griffiths and the Stephen Ranellas and the Danielle Pruitts. They've done a great service. And we can all take a lesson from that and link it to your first reaction when nobody's watching in social media, right? Don't just post the tailgate. Post it as an Instagram reel, right? Your photo of you training the dog, you connecting with the dog and the bird, right? But don't forget to put the meal in that reel.
Yep.
Right? And connect it all together. Does it? Right? You tell the full piece of
That's
the story.
Great,
it's not the blood and the guts. It's not the killing. That's part of it. It's part of the process. But we can link it all together. And to me, when you start thinking about Leopoldisms and the age of social media, there's some truths here. We just got to think about it in a little bit different context, right?
You know, Bob, that's great guidance. I don't post any of that. I don't do social media very much, but certainly don't put my hero shots up there. But I would put my hero shot up there if I followed it up with a picture of eating it for dinner. I'd be proud to do that. That's a great idea.
Yep. Yeah, it is. I was going to just say, those influencers you mentioned, I just had a brilliant idea. It's not a new concept, right? We've kind of been killing and eating things for a long while.
Since the caveman.
Right? But they have taken that piece of it and immersed it in, and now look how many spinoffs there are.
Yeah.
I just, like, kind of noticed that recently where there's, like, a new, you know, Fed Wild or whatever the new TV show is. There's a ton of them out there.
And
it's,
I think
it's
that
great. It draws that connection.
That's
together.
Better than great. I mean, that is.
I agree.
When I think about the future of conservation, it comes back to food.
Right.
And the food comes back to water.
Well, that's and people care about that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great to hear. I'm so far out of the loop. I didn't know. That's great to hear. Seriously. Yeah. That's really exciting.
Well, and I think, you know, how how crazy blown out of proportion the word trophy is. And I've been asked this question, what do you think about trophy hunting? I said, well, it depends on your perspective and the context you wish to present it in. Mm-hmm. A trophy moment for me was the first time my new poodle pointer was a year old and went on point on a wild pheasant.
My head went to the
hardest
exact
thing.
Same place.
Yeah. And it's like, and he pointed it. I walked up. I was actually shocked. Out stumbled the pheasant. He flew. I shot it. And the dog brought it to hand. And I'm like, that was a real trophy moment for me.
And you had a trophy meal.
Exactly.
As a result, because of that dog.
And that's what I missed in my post. But that was a trophy moment. But, I mean, yeah, I think the more we start telling it in that context, I think it can take away some of that negativity of words like trophy.
All right, you get the final quote to go first, Ted.
Okay.
All right, here's the final Leopold quote I picked out. Conservation is getting nowhere because it is incompatible with the Abrahamic it's hard for me to pronounce Leopold quotes. Abrahamic concept of land. We abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect. Also, a very famous Leopold quote. I can't help but think it's perfect for you to go first with this one.
Well, I struggle with this. There's complex layers of meaning to it, right? Mm. My bottom line is, like right now, the rancher conservationist heroes with whom I'm working to save grasslands participate in programs that treat conservation as an afterthought to an otherwise legitimate business activity. Your job is to raise beef for all Americans. And that conservation thing, sure, let's do a little bit of that. And so the inequity is how we value those things. In my opinion, as Americans, we all value clean air and clean water and healthy soils and vegetation and wildlife habitat and carbon sequestration, all of the ecosystem services that come with those ranch lands where these ranchers raise beef. And until we're willing to pay the price that it costs to secure all those other ecosystem services, we'll never truly value it. We literally will not value it. We won't pay as much money. And so the other Leopold quote that comes to mind on this is, ultimately, conservation boils down to rewarding the private landowner who protects the public interest. Now, he talks about, you know, land ownership or resource ownership as an Abrahamic concept that we need to get over. To me, the way we need to get over it is we need to actually pay what it truly costs to secure those conservation values. And I'm not sure if there's a part of that that's not maybe antithetical to that quote of Leopold's. But I know it's entirely consistent with his other quote. So I'd love thoughts from you guys on that. I mean, we truly wake up every day and we don't really pay what it costs to truly protect all these other values of the land. We extract the value of cows eating grass and we sell it. And we don't adequately protect all of those other ecosystem services. We don't adequately value it.
See, I thought about that a little differently, though, too, because part of it is how a rancher, farmer treats the land through conservation improves the soil.
That's
which
right.
Which can improve the yield and whatever the crop is, right?
That's exactly right.
So it is looking at it from a holistic perspective, and not just from the general public, but also from that landowner's perspective.
You know, that's a great response, Bob, and you're right. That's exactly how the ranchers I work with see it. They don't want to mine the grass off of that land and strip it of all of its other values.
Right. It's a long-term investment for them.
That's right.
Because they want to pass that land on to their next generation, right? Most of the best farmers and ranchers get that point.
Totally. Yeah, and you're right. Looking at that more through the lens of the landowner is a helpful way for me to think about that. So, and, you know, you'd share these questions. I thought about it. I came up with another Leopold quote, you know, that we have to reward the landowner. But good answer. Thank you. Well, I see what these guys say. Yeah.
You guys have any reactions?
I think, you know, when I thought about this and kind of took some notes for myself, that, you know, this one, it rings so true today from the day he wrote this quote, viewing things as a commodity. And I think even some of us that love wildlife and nature struggle with this in the in the in-depth nature that he was thinking about this love, this connectedness, this love for nature and respect for it. I think the problem is to have that manifest across all sectors of society has always been our challenge.
Yeah.
There have always been the robber barons. Mm-hmm. I mean, look what Roosevelt was dealing with when he was president. There's always going to be a sector that will never view this as anything more than a commodity. And that's part of our challenge of getting it to manifest. Mm. I don't think we're ever going to be able to convince everybody. The question is, can you convince enough to truly believe in what conservation and its underpinnings are and to follow that philosophy?
I think,
don't know if that was a great answer, yeah. but that's how I think about it.
I thought it was pretty good. Yeah. Better than what I'll come up with. The challenge with the Abrahamic view is that it leads to a far shorter term value for the land itself, right? I mean,
right.
you know, we don't build in environmental degradation to our GDP, which is why it's incredibly easy to look at profit over conservation, yeah. right? Because if you're a shareholder of a company and it's not built into your mission, your business practices, the ethics with which you go about, you know, doing that business, then you wouldn't even consider a longer-term sustainable view. When you're talking about the ranchers, I mean, Bob, I think, you know, you guys actually articulated it really well at the top of the question, right? You know, one is about long-term sustainable value that we derive from the land, and the other leads to tremendously diminished short-term, you know, the value of the land that's looking at it more in the short term. And it's kind of built into our entire financial view of how we operate as businesses. And yeah. until we begin to build in, you know, what we lose in terms of resources to, you know, simple things we love to talk about, GDP, mm-hmm. that's going to be a hard thing to change.
Yeah. The way I have said this for decades, I kind of conjured this up with some buddies over a drink or two when I was working at Weyerhaeuser. And it embodies everything you two just said. The simple way I say it is conservation must become an investment rather than the proverbial impediment.
Yeah. That is exactly
right. And that really embodies what you just said. That's so right. It is an investment if you look at it that way.
But you said it in one sentence, and it took me 20 minutes. <to
laugh. laughs> But that took us all.
Yeah, that was the underpinning.
That was a perfect quote to end on. Guys, thanks for spending so much time. I know this was a little bit of an abstract podcast, but it was fun. We're going to end with one fun final thought. I want to go around the room. We'll start with Ed. You can go on a bird hunt. It's got to be a bird hunt. This is Pheasants Forever.
Absolutely.
Quail Forever's podcast. A bird hunt anywhere for any bird with anyone. Tell me about that dream hunt of yours.
Sharp-tailed grouse, sandhills in Nebraska, by myself. Nice. And I say that because...
Your dog's going to be pissed.
Very good point. By good myself call, with my dog.
with the poodle pointer or a lab?
Yes.
Or both?
Yes.
Yeah, all right.
No, that is my favorite game bird once I was introduced to that. And it embodies just the toughness and gritness of native game birds and what I know now about native grouse and wild places and wild habitats. That's my favorite bird. And actually, it's my favorite bird anywhere. Mm. But I have a deep love for the sandhills.
Yeah.
I hate to say it almost, but I know you guys have said it on the podcast before, and it kind of got hot-spotted by somebody.
Oh, yeah.
And
Sharpies in the sandhills is not a secret.
Yeah, no. But I'll tell you what, I hunted it when it was,
okay.
And it's still pretty damn remote. Right. It's a special, special place, and it's a special thing to be walking in those grasslands and just experiencing it. And it's not even about the bird anymore. I mean, yeah, I want to see them. I want to take them. Kind of back to the point you were making earlier. It's that the experience, I think that grows with you over time.
Yeah.
Because when I was hunting, when I first learned to hunt sharp-tailed, I just wanted limits, mm-hmm. you know, get into as many birds as you can, get the dog into birds. And now it's a very different thing as an aging hunter.
Patrick, where are you taking those springers? I'm assuming you're taking the springers.
That's a silly question, Bob. Although, you know, the person I, to answer that question, always had French Brittany's. And, you know, I had a mentor and a friend, and I only got to hunt, I think, once or twice with him. A guy named Steve Wright, who was fascinating, was originally from Milledgeville, Georgia, and ended up as head of Fish and Wildlife in Vermont. And I remember him saying when I got started, you know, and again, we were already friends. He's like, look, don't focus on this species or that species. Look at the natural systems that support all species, which, by the way, you know, Aldo Leopold's, that book was, it completely changed the trajectory of my life. I remember reading that and being like, chills down my spine, inspired. And I, there were certain quotes that I remember. And one of them is, the first rule of intelligent tinkering is to save all the parts. And that, when Steve was talking about protecting the natural systems and everything in there, like, I was like, that's what he's talking about. Like, you know, but anyway, just a really, just a fascinating guy. I miss him all the time. And I'm sorry, you know, I didn't get to go more on adventures with him, but I'd love to get back in the New England grouse and woodcock tangles with Steve again, whether it's over his French Brit or, you know, one of my Springers, because the time spent with him was always in education and everything around us.
Yeah, that's cool. Ted? My final thoughts, and you get them.
My answer is weird.
And that's a wrap for this episode of, yeah, right.
and this came to mind when I read it, so I'm going to say it. But, yeah, you know, being trained as a scientist and a lifelong lover of native ecosystems in North America, and having my heart broken over every species that has recently become extinct at our hands, I would love to be able to hunt ivory-billed woodpeckers with John James Audubon.
That's just a good one, though, man.
Were they hunted before?
Well, he used to shoot to do his...
Well, sure.
So I would love to have been the one who took the woodpecker for him to draw. Yeah. So it would be a collection hunt, not a meat hunt or a...
Yeah, I'm looking. I don't have that on my bingo card.
but to be in that, but to be in that now lost ecosystem with that now lost species with...
You think they still exist? I mean, I know there are random reports from time to time.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems unlikely.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
And all the more reason that, you know, to have been there, to have seen one, to have been able to take one and have it be the model, you know, for what people learned about ivory-billed woodpeckers from the most famous ornithologist in our history would have been a special experience.
Would there be a dog involved hunting?
I thought about that, and I don't think so. I mean, you'd be sitting in a canoe under some old dead cypress waiting for a woodpecker to show
up. You'd probably train a dog like they train the squirrel dogs.
That's true. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Put it in the front of the canoe and keep paddling until it barks, and then
This is a clear sign I got to bring this one to a close. fellas, thank you very much for spending so much time with me. Ed Arnott, Wildlife Society. What's your website?
Wildlife.org.
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 Patrick Berry, the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Where do you want people to find you?
Backcountryhunters.org.
And Ted Cook?
GrousePartners.org.
There we go. Join them all. I am proud to be a member of all these organizations as well. Hope our Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever listening audience gets involved. They are tremendous organizations and tremendous people. Thanks for sharing the time and insights into the Aldo Leopold quotes. I really didn't see the ivory woodpecker.
I saw that one coming.
Nevertheless, I'll end this episode with always follow the dog. Something good will rise, folks. Thanks for listening.